Anyway, enough from me. Thank you for braving the weather for coming to hear something that's really important from a remarkable man. Would you please welcome Jeremy Moody? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul. I really appreciate your making the effort to be here. I know that some people like to tweet and send out messages. That's great. If you could just put your phones on silent. I've switched mine off because, as you know, the speaker, if their phone is on, you know, there's that bzzz, 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 bzzz that shows that they haven't switched it off. And in my case, I do need to switch it off because some of you may, when you've heard me before, have heard me tell the story that I don't know how many of you know about Embrace. If you don't, then come and see us at our stand. We were used to be Bible Lands. Nobody's heard of Bible Lands. Nobody's heard of Embrace. But everybody's heard of the Bethlehem Carol Sheets. Yes. Okay. So we are the people behind the Bethlehem Carol Sheets. But we don't exist to produce Bethlehem Carol Sheets. We are a development charity. And we support the Christian social witness in the Middle East. So that's all I'm going to say about Embrace. Come and find out about us in the stall in G-Source. But I want to tell you about one of our partners, just while I'm on the subject of mobile phones, because I don't know how many of you have been to Cairo, but there is a suburb of Cairo called Isbat el-Nakhl. You can get there on the Cairo subway. And when you get there, as soon as you come out of the station, you just get this terrible stench. And that's because this is where the rubbish pickers, have you heard of the rubbish pickers, the Zabalin in Cairo? They live there, and they try and eke a living by sorting out the city's rubbish. And right in the middle of this this slum, really, in Cairo, there is a small Coptic Orthodox convent. It's called the Daughters of St. Mary. And we've been partners of theirs for many, many years. They run a kindergarten. They run clinics. They have a center for disabled children. They run adult education classes, really just serving and sharing the compassion of Christ with these rubbish pickers of Cairo. And the nun who runs the Daughters of St. Mary is called Sister Maria. And when she emails me, it comes up on my smartphone as from Jesus Christ. So I'll be talking to you, and suddenly I'll get an email from Jesus Christ. And I think, well, I'm sorry, but I really have to answer this. of course, I realize that it's not from, well, it could be. We are the hands of Jesus, right? So in a way, it is from Jesus Christ. But actually, I realize it's not from Jesus. It's from Sister Maria in the Daughters of St. Mary in the convent in the middle of Isbat el-Nakhl. The other thing about Sister Maria, I have to tell you this before I get onto the subject of Syria, is that her English is not that great. So when she emails me, it comes up on my smartphone from Jesus Christ. I realize it's not from Jesus, but I really should open it up. And it always starts the same. Dear Mr. Jeremy, thank you for your massage. my wife Ruth is sat here in the front here, and that takes some explaining, I can tell you. Can everybody hear me? Yes, good. So, I love putting jokes into my talks, but Syria, it's not so easy, is it? But I was prompted when asked to speak about Syria just to and to select a title. And by the way, there's going to be a time at the end for some discussion and questions, so if things that come up that strike you, then just store them away on your mental hard drive and we can come back to them. But I was prompted by to think of the title, which is Who Are the Good Guys, by this letter which appeared in the Daily Mail about a year ago. You may have heard it. It's from a Mr. Aubrey Bailey of Fleet. In fact, is Mr. Bailey here? Mr. Aubrey Bailey of Fleet in Hampshire? Okay, well, I thought I'd ask because maybe he should come out and read this letter. But anyway. So this is the letter he wrote. He said this: Sir, are you confused by what is going on in the Middle East? Let me explain. We support the Iraqi government in the fight against Islamic State. We don't like IS, but IS is supported by Saudi Arabia, who we do like. We don't like President Assad in Syria. We support the fight against him, but not IS, which is also fighting against him. We don't like Iran, but Iran supports the Iraqi government against IS. So some of our friends support our enemies, and some of our enemies are our friends, and some of our enemies are fighting our other enemies, whom we don't want to lose, but we don't want our enemies who are fighting our enemies to win. If the people we want to defeat are defeated, they might be replaced by people we like even less. And all of this was started by us invading a country to drive out terrorists who weren't actually there until we went in to drive them out. Do you understand now? Well, hats off to Mr. Aubrey Bailey from Fleet in Hampshire for making it all clear. And of course, the point to make about all this is that this letter, which was written a year ago in the Daily Mail, is already out of date. Apparently, we do like Iran nowadays. In fact, my mother-in-law is going to Iran in a few weeks' time. He hopes. That's got me into so much trouble. She is. But anyway, we do like Iran nowadays, although not necessarily to the extent of supporting their fight against IS. And we certainly don't like their Shiite allies, Hezbollah, whom we regard as a terrorist organisation. So the letter's already out of date. And the second point to make about the letter from Mr. Aubrey Bailey of Fleet in Hampshire to the Daily Mail is that he didn't say anything about Turkey and the Kurds. So if we were to update the letter to today, we might say this. We have always liked Turkey. They're members of NATO. They want to join the EU, and we go on there a holiday a lot. But we were surprised to see that they initially supported IS, because both Turkey and IS hate the Kurds. But we like the Kurds and are even giving them military advisors and weapons. And anyway, Turkey has now started bombing IS. So the friends have now become enemies. But Turkey is also still bombing the Kurds. So now our friends are fighting our friends, which makes it more difficult for them both to fight our enemies. Are you still with me? It is confused. And if you prefer things more visual, I actually brought some graphs. Some people have tried to represent graphically who is who in Syria, who likes who hates who. Pass these around. You can see them. They're just a mixture of lines. It's absolutely impossible to represent graphically who are the goodies and who are the baddies in Syria. That's the worst one. Can you see that? There are lines that are hate, enemies, strained, complicated, and good. And that's basically how you describe Syria. That's my talk. Thank you very much for listening. Bye-bye. So it is complicated. Pass these around. Anyway, if you're still confused about Syria, I suppose I feel a bit bad about making jokes about this, but if we get the point behind the jokes, then hopefully you'll indulge me. Because apparently somebody else said it's all about the beards. Did you hear this? It's all about the beards. Anthony Lloyd, he is a journalist. He for the Times, he was actually kidnapped in Syria a while back and was very lucky to escape with his life. He got out, and he wrote a feature in the Sunday Times a few weeks ago. I don't know how many of you saw it, but he said this. It's all about the beards. Long beard, no moustache, short hair, Salafist. So that's a fairly extreme Islamist, but not as extreme as Islamic State. So long beard, no moustache, short hair, Salafist. Long beard, long hair, Islamic State. Short hair, trimmed beard, could be YPG, which are the Kurds, or FSA, which is the Free Syrian Army, the supposedly moderate Libyan Syrian rebels. Close-shaven beard, short hair, Hezbollah. That makes me Hezbollah, by the way. Clean-shaven, short hair, Syrian Army. So that's it. So let's stand up, guys, with the beards. Let's see whose side you're on. Okay, there's quite a few Islamists here, I can see. Anyway, my point is that if the politicians and letter writers to the Daily Mail and the experts and the analysts and the academics and even the barbers can't quite work out What is going on in Syria? How can we, mere mortals? I mean, we're Christians. Many of us here are Christians. We pray for the world, don't we? Who do we pray for in Syria? And I'd have to tell you this. We are called to pray for Syria. You know, there's that verse in Isaiah. Psalm 122. It says this, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. How many times have you heard people say that that means praying for the state of Israel? Actually, it doesn't. It means praying for all of the people in Jerusalem and the whole of that region. And in Isaiah, it says this, blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance. Assyria, which of course was a bit bigger than Syria is today, was God's handiwork. Jesus ministered in Syria. It is a holy land. So when you pray for Israel and Palestine, pray for Egypt, where the Holy Family fled to. Pray for Syria, where Jesus ministered. It says in Matthew 4 that the gospel was spread in Syria. So we're called to pray for Syria, but who do we pray for? Who are the good guys? Well, I thought that one way of answering this question, perhaps, was actually to look at who are the bad guys. Because that's a lot easier question to answer. And the first point is that in one way, we are all bad guys. I'll tell you why. Because one of the major causes of the revolution in Syria was climate change. Did you know that? First of all, the whole Arab Spring, which began in Tunisia in 2011, a major driver behind that were food shortages and massive increases in food prices throughout the Middle East and North Africa caused by drought and famine and food shortages. So that was a factor behind the Arab Spring as a whole. And then in Syria in particular, for about 5-6 years prior to the start of the rebellion in 2011, there'd been a terrible drought, the worst drought that Syria has seen for decades. And about 800,000 people moved from the rural areas into the cities. Can you imagine that? And so, and they went into the cities, and the government mishandled the whole drought issue, the whole issue of license. They said you had to license wells. They only gave the wells the right to make wells to certain people who were friends of the government. And it was children demonstrating in the town of Dara in early 2011 against the problems caused by the drought and climate change. And they were arrested by the Syrian authorities and tortured, and then there were more rebellions, and so it went on. And so, in one sense, those of us who are not taking climate change seriously, we are partly the bad guys here, because climate change and drought and all that follows from climate change is having not just economic consequences across the whole of the Middle East and North Africa, but it is having very, very severe political consequences as well. So, having made you feel really guilty, who are some of the more obvious bad guys in Syria? Well, of course, we know about the Islamic State. There's been little else on our TV screens over the last year since they took over the Iraqi second city of Mosul. The beheadings, the atrocities, the abuse of women, the destruction of heritage sites. You may have heard on your radio this morning that the biggest site in Palmyra looks to have been severely damaged, if not destroyed. The world has not seen such barbarism, possibly since Genghis Khan or Attila the Hun. As Robert Fisk wrote in The Independent recently, Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan, they had all the beheadings and the crucifixions and the slavery and the torture. The only difference now are the videotapes. But I'm not going to dwell on Islamic State now because we just know about those. They're ubiquitous on our TV screens. And also, I'm covering it on a panel discussion this afternoon with Jeff Halper and possibly somebody else. But before I move on from Islamic State, I do want to make two important points. And the first is one where I actually happen to agree with David Cameron, which might be surprising. But actually, David Cameron has joined a number of MPs in saying, don't use the term Islamic State. My Muslim friends get very upset when they only hear the word Islamic mentioned in connection with the atrocities of Islamic State. Islamic State is not Islamic, and it is not a state. States are meant to protect their citizens, not terrorize them. They are meant to provide the basics to their citizens, not to inflict a medieval form of Sharia law on them. Islamic State is not a state. It is not Islamic. Over 120 MPs have written to the BBC, imploring the BBC to stop using the term Islamic State. For some reason, the BBC has refused to accede to that request. So what can we call them? Well, there's a word in Arabic, and it's quite difficult because it has a guttural sound. Are there any Arabic speakers here? It's Daesh, right? Daesh. But you've got to get that guttural thing in there. Daesh is the Arabic for the original name of Islamic State, ISIL, Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, Islamic State. And it's the Islamic State people hate it because it's very similar to another Arabic word, which is to crush or to trample down. And by calling, and so everybody in the region who hates Islamic State calls them Daesh. And so actually we are standing in solidarity with those millions of people in the Middle East who want no time with the Islamic State when we call them Daesh, not Islamic State. So that's my first point. And I think the second point I want to make about Islamic State, or Daesh, as I shall call them from now on, is that especially those of us in the church, we've tended to focus on the plight of the Christians in the Middle East. And I don't want to in any way diminish or understate how Daesh have impacted on the Christians of the region. But I was listening to a sermon in a church just a few weeks ago, and the pastor was preaching, and he mentioned, just in passing, that about 170,000 people had been killed by Daesh, or he used the term Islamic State, most of whom were Christians. That's not true. Actually, I suspect that probably those killed by Daesh is not nearly as many as 170,000. That's not to say that it won't get to that, but it's unlikely to be that high. And secondly, it's not a majority of Christians. The people who are really suffering at the hands of Daesh are other Muslims. And somehow, when we're only concerned about the Christians, again, that reinforces for many Muslims that sense that we only care for our own. It's Yazidi. You've heard about the Yazidi in Iraq. It's the Sunni, the Shia, who are regarded as heretics by the Sunni. Even many Sunni who don't accept the extreme medieval form of Sharia law that Daesh are trying to introduce, even they have suffered beheadings and murder. The vast majority of people who have suffered at the hands of Daesh over the last year are not Christian. In fact, many of the Christians in Iraq and Syria have fled before Daesh arrived. So yes, do pray for the Christians of the Middle East. They need your prayers. But don't forget the others who are also suffering at the hands of Daesh. So that's Islamic State, Daesh. We know that they are the bad guys. But who are the other bad guys? If Daesh are the top of the list, then who else is on the list? And I've got quite a long list, and it might surprise you. First of all, and I hate to say this, I don't want to be an old Francophobe, it's the French. Let's hear it for the French. You see, just as we Brits screwed up Palestine, the French screwed up Syria. They were allocated Syria after the First World War, just as we were allocated, as if somehow it was ours to dispose of, Palestine, after the First World War. And what they did, classic imperial ploy, is to make the minority the top dogs, because that way they divide and rule. So they made the Alawites, who are a kind of Shia sect, the top dogs in Syria, so that they could effectively use the Alawites to control the Sunni majority. And that was after the First World War. And the Alawites are still in power. President Assad and his father, Hafiz al-Assad, were also from the Alawite minority. And so the French really are, in a way, responsible for creating Syria. You notice that the borders are quite straight. The borders have no logic at all. It was we Brits and French who drew up those borders. And today, the Alawites are barely 10% of the population. The Sunnis, maybe 3/4. Sunni hatred of Alawite rule, which had been there from the time of the French, was one of the factors, in addition to climate change and drought, which caused the initial demonstrations 4 years ago. So we have to blame the French. That's okay. We always blame the French for everything. But, I mean, we Brits, those of us who are Brits, we have to take our responsibility as well. Because we carved up the region. We gave the French carte blanche because we wanted Palestine. Some of you have heard of the Sykes-Picot Agreement of 1916. We're approaching the centenary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Many of the problems in Iraq, in Syria, in Israel and Palestine go all the way back to a line in the sand that was drawn by Sir Mark Sykes, a great imperial adventurer, and his opposite number, Monsieur Picot. So we are complicit as well. The reason why we wanted our bits was we wanted to protect our oil interests, we wanted to protect the Suez Canal, and we thought that actually by creating a Jewish homeland in Palestine, the Jews would be sympathetic to Britain and therefore our imperial interests would be protected. Dr. Fawaz Gerges, who is the director of the Middle East Centre at the London School of Economics, he is scathing of his criticism of Britain and France and our role in creating the current crisis. He writes this: they, Britain and France, created the contemporary Arab world. They played God and produced mutilated entities that almost a century later are coming apart. So maybe I'm making you feel a bit guilty, but it gets worse. You see, in many ways, the whole of us in the West are responsible. We are the bad guys. Having created the ethnic and political mess that is Syria and Iraq, and then having decided that we didn't fancy the dictators who were the only people who could hold these contrived countries together, we then decided that we want to topple them. So we toppled Saddam under the pretext of weapons of mass destruction, which didn't exist. And look at the mess that we've got. And we're now trying to topple Assad, and in the process of trying to topple him, he's a brutal, evil dictator, as was Saddam. But we don't see things through, and in toppling Saddam, we just created a mess, and we're doing the same in Syria. And as a result, we're now confronted with what is probably the worst humanitarian disaster since the last war. It's certainly probably the worst refugee crisis since the end of the Second World War. In 1945, at least 250,000 dead. You know the statistics, but it's just worth, and they are mind-numbing, but we just need to put a root into the statistics. Over 250,000 dead in the Syrian civil war, possibly as many as 300,000. Over 4 million refugees in the neighboring countries, particularly Turkey, Lebanon, and Jordan. And 7 million internally displaced persons. That's 11 million people displaced from their homes, half of the population. Can you imagine that? If that were happening in Britain, that would be about 30 million people displaced from their homes. Can you imagine that? And how does the West respond to this crisis which it helped create? Okay, so there's a UN appeal last year, $6 billion needed to try and address, through the refugee work and so on, some of the consequences of this crisis that we helped create. Even today, over halfway through 2015, last year's appeal is barely half funded. The UN followed it up with a second appeal for 2015, $7.4 billion. We're over halfway through the year, and it's barely 30% funded. It's like we create this mess, and then we wash our hands of it. Meanwhile, Syrians, who are just trying to get out of this mess and save their lives, are trying to get into Europe. And they're exploited by traffickers. The terrible scenes on that Austrian motorway lay-by in these last few days. 71, all of them Syrians, some of them children. Or the Syrians who drowned in the capsized hull off Libya. And what do our politicians do? They're not stumping up the cash. What do? They refer to them as swarms marauding around Europe. We created this mess, treating these people as if they were insects, not humans. My friends, I believe that our government's stance, the West's stance on Syria, is a disgrace. And unless it changes, things will only get worse. But you'll see that actually, I haven't even got on to the more obvious baddies. Okay, Islamic State, Daesh, I've talked about. The Assad regime, of course. How could we possibly see a regime that drops barrel bombs on its own people, chemical weapons, as anything other than a baddie? What about the moderate Syrian opposition? Well, it doesn't really exist. It never really existed. It existed in our own sort of imaginations in the West. It's deeply divided. In fact, most of the weapons that we've tried to give to the moderate Syrians has ended up in the hands of Daesh. What about the Gulf states like Saudi Arabia and Qatar, who have provided a lot of the funding for Daesh? Why? Because they're fighting a proxy war against Iran. It's a Sunni-Shia battle. And this despite the fact that the very Daesh which they created, their long-term goal is to topple the pro-Western regimes in Qatar and Saudi Arabia. So they are going to be toppled in the game plan by the very people that they started to fund. Can you work that one out? And then we come to Turkey. Turkey, which, as I said, is ambivalent about Daesh. Turkey was... I was actually speaking to someone who works in Istanbul yesterday and was really hearing about how Turkey was turning a blind eye to the Islamists who were getting into Syria to fight the battle, and now it's bombing them. Why? Because why was it supportive? Because it thought that they could deal with the Kurds, who are also their enemies. Then there's Russia and China, who are trying to pop up Assad because of their extensive economic interests and because they want to poke the Americans in the eye. Or the foreign fighters. One of the things about Daesh is that hardly any of them, or very few of them, are Syrian or Iraqi. Actually, most of them come from other parts of the world. They're there not because they really care a fig about Syria or Iraq. They're there because they're fighting global jihad. So, I mean, this is pretty relentless, isn't it? And I'm sorry for that. But one common theme that emerges through all this is that apart from a dodgy and brutal dictator in Assad and a fragmented domestic opposition, nearly all of the baddies that I've mentioned are not even Syrian. Did you notice that? They're around the world. They're the global powers. They're us who aren't doing anything about climate change. They're the French. They're the British. Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, the Saudis, the Qataris. Everyone has their finger in the pie that is Syria. Which is why the second misnomer that I want to highlight this morning, the first was not to call Islamic State Islamic State, but call them Daesh. The second is that this is not a civil war. A civil war is fought by people within a country of the same nationality. Nobody actually in Syria uses the term civil war. If you talk to the regime, the Assad regime, it's a war against terrorism. If you talk to the moderate opposition, such as is left of it, it's a war against a brutal dictatorship. If you're talking to the Kurds, it's a war about self-determination for the Kurds. And if you talk to Daesh, which I don't recommend, it's a jihad to create an Islamic caliphate with Sharia law. But whatever the internal motivations of these different forces, all of these parties are being egged on by external forces, forces which are outside Syria. You've probably heard that what is going on in Syria is not a civil war, but a proxy war. A proxy war is where two parties are in conflict with each other, but without actually directly engaging each other. They fight through proxies. And the reality today is that Syria isn't a proxy war, it is a multi-proxy war. It's actually being fought on four different levels. Level one, the Shia of Iran and Hezbollah, and partly in Iraq.
versus the Sunni Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia and Qatar, and their US backers. So Shia versus Sunni, level one. Level two, a superpower battle between Russia and China on the one hand and America. You might think, aren't we all friends now? No, they're still fighting their battles, and it's ordinary Syrians who are dying. Thirdly, it's a battle between the Turks and the Kurds. And fourthly, it's a jihad from people wanting to topple Western-backed regimes in the Middle East and create the Islamic Caliphate. So four proxy wars, all descending on Syria. Blessed be Assyria, my handiwork, the place where Jesus ministered. This is what's happening in Syria today. But it's actually the very nature of these proxy battles that gives me some hope for the future. And as Christians, we do have to have hope for a better future. The battle between Iran and the Gulf states, that for regional hegemony, that must come to a conclusion at some stage. And, of course, Iran being brought back into the fold with the nuclear deal, you'll hear much opposition to it, especially from Israel. But to the extent that Iran is brought back into the community of nations, there is hope that maybe the Gulf states and Iran will settle their differences, and in which case, again, Syrians won't be the ones who suffer in the middle. The superpowers, Russia and China, as they fight for regional power in the region, they will come a point where maybe it's 300,000 Syrians, maybe it's 500,000 Syrians. At some point, the number of dead Syrians won't be worth fighting that regional battle anymore. Turkey, at some stage, will have to reach an accord with the Kurds, much as Israel will, for its own security, at some stage, have to agree to share the land with the Palestinians. You cannot deny, I mean, the Palestinians and the Kurds have much in common. They are probably the two biggest national groups who are denied a state today. So that can't go on forever. And I believe that the sheer brutality and medievalism of the jihadi Johns in Daesh will eventually turn ordinary Muslims against them. And indeed, I think probably already is. Whether these proxy battles reach their natural conclusion in a year's time or 5 years' time or 10 years' time, I don't really know. The doomsayers would say that the average modern civil war lasts 10 years. In fact, there's some pointy-headed academic who studied civil wars, and he apparently says 10 years is what they last. Except when there are outside forces that are influencing that civil war, they last longer. So maybe 15 years. But let's hope that it's shorter. We must pray for a quicker resolution than that. But I haven't yet answered my own question. Who are the good guys? Who are the good guys? Thank you very much. Well, I believe that there's a simple answer to this question. First, there are the ordinary Syrians who never asked this upon their heads. Maybe 20, 22 million of them. Over half of them, as I have said, displaced from their homes. Some of them began demonstrating because they could not get water following the drought. Others began demonstrating because of the denial of basic human rights under the Assad dictatorship. They thought that they could join the demonstrators in Tunis and Benghazi and Cairo and actually achieve a better life for themselves. The Assad regime responded with great brutality. They didn't expect, as a result of that, all of the world, the Gulf powers, Turkey, America, Britain, Russia, China, to pile in to the situation. And now it's the ordinary Syrians who are suffering. So I would say that the good guys, first of all, are the ordinary Syrians whom we must pray for and support. Secondly, there are, in all of this mess, people who want to bring healing and peace and reconciliation. And of course, the work of Embrace is very much about that work of healing and peace and reconciliation. We are supporting the Christians of the region, not just in Syria, but in Lebanon and in Egypt and elsewhere, as they are trying to respond to this terrible crisis. One of our patrons at Embrace is Bishop Angelos of the Coptic Church. You may have heard of him, a lovely, lovely man. And he once said this, "We who are reconciled in Christ must also have a reconciling presence in society. When we become reconcilers and peacemakers, we become most like Christ." course, he had in mind that wonderful verse from 2 Corinthians. All this is from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. And so the historic Christians of the region are responding. You might think, when you think of Middle East Christians, they're all hiding under their beds waiting for Daesh to arrive, or they're all fleeing. Some Christians are fleeing, but there are many other Christians who are staying there. They trace their origins right back to the time of Jesus. That's why Sister Maria of the Daughters of St. Mary, of the convent in Esbetelnachol, when her email comes up, it's from Jesus Christ. She identifies with Jesus in a way that we Western Christians really can't. And so they want to stay there and continue to be a witness, sharing the compassion of Christ with their neighbors. These Christians deserve not only our prayers, but also our solidarity and our fellowship and our support. That's why at Greenbelt this weekend, Embrace has been promoting the mattress appeal. Basically, there are about 1 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. It's swollen the population by about a quarter. It's placed massive strains on the Lebanese society, on social infrastructure. You may have seen in the last week or so demonstrations about the failure to collect the rubbish in Beirut. Again, the whole social infrastructure of Lebanon is collapsing under the weight of over 1 million refugees. Many of these refugees are scattered around Lebanon. Some of them are in camps. Some of them are just living in the most impossible conditions. And the Lebanese Christians are just ministering to their needs. And in fact, we've spent about over $500,000, or committed over £500,000 to supporting work amongst Syrian refugees throughout the region. And if you want to find out more, our program manager for Syria, who's not working this weekend, is here, Lydia. Give it up for Lydia, who's working so hard. Lydia's working so hard on just getting support out to our Christian partners. But one of the amazing things is that as the Syrian refugees queued up for food parcels and other relief assistance in Lebanon, the first thing they often said was, "You do know that we're Muslims, don't you?" It's like they couldn't quite believe that the Christians of the region would help them. They would think, well, the Christians don't like us, not only because we're Muslim, but also because we're Syrians, and the Syrians have occupied large parts of Lebanon for many years. There's great enmity. But the Lebanese Christians who are providing this relief, they just see people in need. This is the quintessential Good Samaritan story in the very land where Jesus taught about the Good Samaritan. And so the mattress campaign is just another stage of that. Some of the children who've been in the Bekaa Valley, refugee children, have had the same soggy, wet, flea-infested mattress for 3 years or more. They don't have schooling. This mattress is their life. It's where they sit. It's where they read. It's where they try and play. And it is just a mess. And so we're working with local Christians to provide fresh mattresses. It's a very small thing, but for just £12, you can provide a mattress. So I encourage you to just connect with the Embrace stand. Don't all go and see Lydia, because she's not working this weekend, and she won't thank me for that. But if you want to speak to her, then speak to her. But just check out our website, because we can stand in support of the Christians and their witness. So that's who I think the good guys are, the ordinary Syrians who never invited all this mess on their heads. And those people, not just the Christians, but our work is to support the Christians who are working for peace and reconciliation and bringing the healing of Christ into the lives of those who are suffering. When the fighting stops, we want these same Christians of Lebanon and Syria and Palestine and Egypt, the whole region, to be part of the rebuilding process. There will come a time all civil wars end. Our prayer must be that this war will end sooner rather than later. But there will come a time when this war will end, and we want the Christians still to be there. We don't want them in trucks on Austrian motorway laybys. We don't want them in Calais. We want them staying in their country, in the country where they've been for 2,000 years or more. We want them to stay there and continue to be a witness. These are the good guys in this terrible war. But seeing them and thinking about them is not enough. And talking about them, we also need to stand in solidarity with them. Thank you very much. So we've got about We've got about 20 minutes, I think. As I say, there will be a panel discussion on Daesh and the broader Middle East context this afternoon, 2:30 here in Pagoda. Jeff Halper, myself, and hopefully another panel member. So, but are there any particular questions that there is a roving couple of roving microphones, Heather and somebody else? So, Tricia, both Embrace colleagues. So, yes, sir. I'm picking the guy who's most difficult for you to get to, Heather.
Testing. Okay.
Hi, I'm an Embrace supporter, and I noted the few years ago we went to Israel, some of the interfaith dialogue that goes on in Israel and Palestine. One of the problems that you highlighted was this, not the carve-up of the region by the Western powers, but also the ongoing kind of tension and conflict between the Sunni and the Shia traditions, which is playing into this whole thing and the proxy wars going on. So I wanted to ask how we as Christians in this country and also in Brace maybe help facilitate dialogue between Sunni and Shia to diffuse some of these ancient things. We're so much aware that Christianity's horrible history of sectarian division, which led to wars all over Europe, and how we can help the Muslim community to rebuild bridges between their traditions too?
Well, that's a very good question. I suppose one obvious answer to that is, who are we as Christians to try and get Sunni and Shia or other forms of Islam? I mean, they need to put their own house in order. They need to establish their own platform for dialogue, for sharing common ground. Of course, Shia and Sunni are coexisting in many parts of the region. And to the extent that there has been enmity between Shia and Sunni, as I said, it's largely been stoked by external forces who are fighting their proxy battles. So what I think is important for the Christians is that somebody once said that the Christians of the Middle East are very much like the lubricants of that region. They've been there. They see themselves as Middle Eastern Arab first. They've been there since the time of Jesus. They see themselves as Syrians first, or Egyptians, or Lebanese, or Palestinian, and their very presence in their community has, if you like, been a kind of had a lubricating effect on the different communities. And so, the best way that we as a Christian church can facilitate better relations, not even between Sunni and Shia, but, for example, between Jews and Palestinians in Israel-Palestine, is by ensuring that there is a Christian presence still there. So, for example, we partner in Israel-Palestine with a partner called Musallaha, which is Arabic for reconciliation. You must know that very well. And they are bringing Palestinians and Jews together. There are other ministries, and I think that's because we as Christians have reconciliation. We who are reconciled must be reconcilers. So I would say that in terms of facilitating discussions, that's probably a bit above our pay grade, because who are we to facilitate discussions between Sunni and Shia? What we can do is just be there, be the reconcilers. We who are reconciled are to be reconciled. That's my answer to your question. Okay, we'll go flip over this side.
I wonder what discussions you can initiate or keep going in the UK. You're incredibly knowledgeable. You're incredibly articulate. Thank you very much for that. I really appreciated that. You got a round of applause for saying the Western response to the situation is lamentable. What political action locally or pressure might you reckon positive? And do you have any sort of entree into the Foreign Office, into the Arabists? I mean, do you talk to them?
Well,
do they talk to you?
You weren't here. You may not have been here 2 years ago when I spoke about the fact that I was for 10 years a diplomat. So the Foreign Office is my old stomping ground. But a serious answer to that question: what can we do? Well, I have to tell you that probably in the near future there will be a vote coming to Parliament about Britain extending its bombing missions into Syria. We're already bombing in Iraq, and Parliament, you may recall, a while back gave David Cameron a very bloody nose. He went to Parliament, wanted to bomb in Syria, and although at that time he wanted to bomb Assad. following the chemical weapons. But he has got the defence secretary has already said, we want to come back to Parliament to get the right to bomb, but not the same people, now IS in Syria. The reality is that if all you do is bomb, then you just end up with civilian casualties who then feel that, again, it's the West against us, and it's actually a recruiting slogan for Daesh. And so... and you may have seen, in fact, in the Sunday Times, I think it was yesterday, there was some former general saying that if only Cameron had intervened in Syria earlier, then we wouldn't have had this problem. You know, the military drive to intervene with bombs in that region is great, and it will come back to Parliament, but it will be a disaster. Because just bombing people does not solve the problem. We've seen that in countless campaigns. So I think the first thing is, when the vote comes back to Parliament, write to your MP and say, you know, please don't support yet more bloodshed. You will not reduce the bloodshed in Syria or Iraq by creating more bloodshed. I think secondly, it's about getting the governments to stand up to their humanitarian responsibilities. As I said, hopefully you got a feel for the fact that the response to the UN humanitarian appeals is lamentable. And it's not just Syria. If you look at the appeal for Gaza, I mean, there's a massive appeal for Gaza, which is struggling to rebuild, not just because Israel won't let in the construction materials, but also because there's no money. That is also barely a third funded. And Gaza is a testing ground for American hardware. So again, we're creating the problem, but we're not solving the problem, doing anything to solve it. So I think we should bring pressure onto our politicians to actually start responding in a positive way, but not just sending in the RAF, because that's not going to work. The Foreign Office. I mean, the Foreign Office is an irrelevance, frankly, on this. I mean, at the end of the day, this kind of policy is decided by Number 10. Cameron, as I said, I don't really agree with David Cameron. David Cameron, I think, this isn't going to be quoted, but... I think he's developed the same messianic complex that Tony Blair had, and therefore, you know, something has to be done, and I don't think they necessarily think through. So I think the Foreign Office in this context, and if there's any Foreign Office people here, I apologise, but I think it's probably an irrelevance. Next question over here, maybe. Sir.
Yeah, I want to get you to expand on the role of one particular country which is itching to become a major player in the Middle East. That, of course, is Russia. Hmm. Britain, we know, has a long historical pathological fear of Russia coming into the Middle East and getting dangerously close to the Suez Canal that goes right back to the Crimean War. But Russia is a country with 1,000 years of Christian history, apart from 70 years of communism. Very, very many Christians in the Middle East are Orthodox. And Orthodox Christians all over the world tend to see Russia as their protector. Can you expand on Russia's aims and interests and the consequences, of good or bad, of their becoming involved as a major player there?
Well, that's a good question. Of course, the great superpower battle in that part of the region was called the Great Game. You've heard of that phrase. And it was fought in Afghanistan and the Indian subcontinent and now the Middle East. I don't think it's true to say today that the Orthodox Christians of the Middle East have a particular affection for Russia. Of course, historically, Russia saw itself as the protector of the Christians, and that was one of the factors behind the Crimean War. And in fact, Embrace the Middle East was started in 1854 as a response to the Crimean War. So it's something that we have an interest in. I think today it's simply about Putin trying to score political points off America. I think it's about Putin trying to recreate, to some extent, the Cold War battles of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and also access to oil in the region. So I think it's all about power politics, less about the Christians of the region having any particular affinity. And the point is that ultimately, by fighting our battles, our proxy battles, the West versus Russia in the region, whether it's Syria or Iraq or elsewhere, is we're creating even more instability. So actually, it's not achieving the goal. One of the problems is that there's always the law of unintended consequences. I mean, if I come back to the Israel-Palestine issue, I would argue that Israel has a right to security and to protect its borders and to protect its citizens. But it will always struggle to do that so long as it denies the Palestinians their own state and their own homeland. And so it's the law of unintended consequences. The Russia and the states may well be thinking that they can exert their influence in the region, but in fighting those battles, all they're doing is making things worse. So I think the historic involvement of Russia in the region is very, very interesting, but I wouldn't say that many people are looking for Russia to be their savior today. Okay, another question over here. How are we doing? We've got another 5 minutes or so. Any more questions? This lady here.
I've got a question and a bit of a plug. The question is, what is it that compels a young British woman to pack up her bags and her four children and to go out to ostensibly a terrorist, to join a terrorist organisation? That's the thing. The plug is, Save the Children Fund have produced a video on YouTube called If Surrey Was Syria. And what they've done is they've arranged the closure of a local school, and then they've hidden cameras and recorded the reaction of local people. And it's just a very interesting watch in order to sort of get some empathy.
Okay, so, well, thank you for that. Okay. I commend that video. In answer to the first question, what persuades a family from wherever in the UK to go out to Syria? I think it's very difficult for us to understand the motivations. I think the main one is the belief that they're going to this pure caliphate where Islamic law rules. I think it's a reaction partly to the increased demonization of Muslims in our society. I think there's been a trend since 9/11 to see, and again, you see it, the very word Islamic State seems to be damning the word Islamic every time it's used. And so the combination of increased Islamophobia, just read the Daily Mail or Melanie Phillips or a lot of the right-wing press or The Spectator or The Daily Express, increased Islamophobia combined with a reaction to some extent towards secularism in our society, and suddenly the caliphate seems like the Holy Grail. It's the place where they can be true Muslims, and as a result of social media projecting this perfect Islamic society, some people, naive, I agree, are drawn into that, the government's program here in the UK to counter that kind of ideology is clearly not working, as evidenced by the number of families who are going. But I think we would do well to start by reining back Islamophobia, because that is a major factor. It's creating a them versus us culture. So in that context, the Islamic Caliphate seems to be the Garden of Eden. Okay, a question over here. Yes.
First of all, as someone else has said, thank you so much. I do feel actually a lot clearer despite what you said at the beginning. I wasn't very knowledgeable before. I'm interested to know more about the moderate Syrian opposition, the Free Syria Army, and if you know anything about the Syrian Republican Party. I'm asking because I've got a refugee friend who's involved with the Syrian Republican Party.
Well, I don't know a lot about the Syrian Republic Party in particular. In many ways, the Syrian opposition, it's a bit like that scene in The Life of Brian. You know, are you Judean People's Front or People's Front of Judea? This is what the Syrian moderate opposition is like. It is so splintered. I mean, I think the last time the FSA is just the military arm of one of the supposedly moderate wings, which is part of the Syrian National Council, which wasn't in the moderate coalition. There are dozens of organizations, and some turned up to Geneva for the talks that happened a few years ago, and others didn't because they didn't think they should be talking to the regime. So, and the FSA, as I said, one of the problems is that a lot of the loyalties are tribal in that area, and a lot of the motivations are monetary. And at the moment, the FSA has no money, despite the Western support. It's Daesh that has the money and the hardware, especially having seized FSA depots and, of course, the Iraqi army depots in Mosul after the fall of Mosul in June. So at the moment, Daesh are paying more. So people who were fighting for the FSA are now fighting for Daesh because they get better pay. So the moderate. So I can't answer your question about the Syrian Republic Party, but the moderate opposition as a whole has basically disintegrated, and is not a meaningful force anymore. There is a map if you go on Wikipedia, which shows as of earlier this month. The allocation of the territory inside Syria between Daesh, the Syrian government, the other rebels, and the al-Nusra Front. And really, the areas held by the moderates are quite small. So at the moment, it's primarily a battle between Daesh and the government. So I think that's all I can say to your question. Okay, probably time for one more question, if there's any more questions. Oh, at the back there. This gentleman at the back, maybe? Can you see?
Yep. Sorry. Tinkerbell impression.
If you could do the Sykes-Picot agreement again, and you were not the Frenchman, what would you do? And al-Nusra.
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, we're coming up to some momentous anniversaries in the next few years. Next year is the centenary of the Sykes-Picot Agreement. The year after, it's the centenary of the Balfour Declaration. And both of those have in common the imperial hubris behind the notion that we, as an imperial power, could divvy up or allocate another nation's land. So, I mean, with the benefit of hindsight and progressive thought and the fact that none of us are imperialists anymore, I can't really answer that question because I would not be so presumptuous as to divide up another nation's land. Of course, what's interesting in the context of Sykes-Picot and the Balfour Declaration of a year later was that they were done in the heat of war. And I think it is important to say that, you know, it's easy for us. I mean, I would say in our comfortable mattresses, but if you're going back to soggy mattresses yourselves, then that may not be the right thing to say. But in the comfort of our Western existence, it's very difficult for us to put ourselves in the mindsets of the politicians of the 1916 and 1917 who were just desperate to win what was going to be the war event to end all wars. And Sykes-Picot was about restoring Allied interest in the region to ensure to stop another war, in particular to stop Russian influence, and going back to the question here, and Balfour was about securing a Jewish homeland because Britain thought that the Jews would be more sympathetic, and also it would keep Russia in the war and bring America into the war. So, with the benefit of hindsight, I think the League of Nations, which was established shortly afterwards, was talking about the right of self-determination. And what we should have done was give the Arab nations that had come out of the Ottoman Empire the right to determine their own future. And the quote from Fawaz Gerges is really the one that I want to leave you with. We played the role of God in 1916. We shouldn't have done so, although it's easy for us to say that now because we weren't fighting for our lives in the First World War. But we have the power of God in some senses now, to stop the foreign intervention, to respond to the humanitarian crisis, to respond to the migrant crisis that we have helped create. So to the extent that we have that power, for God's sake, let's use it.
Okay.
Thank you very much. If I can also Thank you. You've been a very attentive and a very engaged audience. Thank you very much. I appreciate your making the effort in the rain. Do check out the Embrace stand in G-Source. Do pick up one of the bags that we're handing out. And do please check out our mattress appeal. It's on our website. You can just for £12, you can make a real difference to some of these refugees. Thank you very much.